Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Oh, that's so good. And it's so much fun to see some familiar faces in the audience. So it's my absolute pleasure to welcome you to this evening's program, which is being hosted by two organizations, the Contemporary Asian Theater Scene, otherwise known as CATS, and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. And my name's Colleen Wilcox, and I'm fortunate enough to serve on the Board of Governors for the Commonwealth Club. And I also at this time want to take a moment to thank the Bernard Osher Foundation for supporting the radio broadcast for this program. And we are really proud to present this program as a collaboration of these two cultural organizations. And to find out more about these organizations, their membership, and what they offer, you can go to Facebook and look for CATS on the Contemporary Asian Theater Scene, or www.commonwealthclub.org if you're interested in participating and learning a little bit more. Now, while I say that, you might know that we have two women who are going to be presenting this evening, and I'm here as a female, and so it's Women's Night. So because it's Women's Night, I have been given a special option, of offering a membership. Now, typically, a membership goes for $125 a year. Are you aware of that? Tonight, $59. Whether you're a girl or a boy. Isn't this good? So anyway, we hope that at the end of the program, after you buy a book and get it autographed, that you will also sign up for membership at the Commonwealth Club if you are not already a member. So, as you know, in all of our programs, we have time for questions and answers. And you either had this on your seat or received one of these as you came in. Is that correct? Do most of you have one? So what we're going to ask is that you write any questions that you have, and during the entire program, some of our staff members and volunteers will be collecting these throughout the program. And those collectors just kind of raise your hands, and so you don't need to worry about it. Just pass them toward the end, and they'll come get them. And so that way you get a chance to ask your personal questions. The club is really so proud not only to be able to broadcast many of our programs, but also to podcast a number of our programs. And they can be heard on KQED 99.88.FM on Friday nights at 8 o'clock. But if you're an early bird, you can also hear it on KLIV at 1590 AM on Thursday night at 7 o'clock. So they're pretty much standard. So if you tune in on those times, you can catch many of these fabulous programs. And, of course, we are going to air the program that you will hear on those radio stations. And because of that, we ask that you please take out your phones and silence them, just to make sure that we don't have the distraction for our radio programming. And while you do that, I'm going to wait just a few seconds to begin the taping of tonight's program. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this evening's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and Contemporary Asian Theater Scene. My name is Colleen Wilcox, and it is absolutely a pleasure to introduce Sandra Singh Low. She is a contributing editor for the Atlantic Monthly and the author of The Mad Woman in the Volvo, My Year of Raging Hormones. Sandra is a performance artist, a writer, a comedian, a scientist, a musician, and a composer. She has written several successful shows, including Aliens in America, I Worry, Mother on Fire, and Sugar Plum Fairy, which she performed at the San Jose Repertory Theater. Sandra is a regular commentator on NPR Morning Edition and PRI This American Life, and her syndicated daily segment, The Lowdown on Science, is heard weekly by 4 million people. She is a 3-time National Magazine Award nominee and won the Pushcart Prize for her short story, My Father's Chinese Wives. She's a McDowell Fellow Award recipient, and Sandra was also named one of the 50 most influential comedians by Variety magazine. As a graduate of California Institute of Technology, Sandra was granted the highest honor, the Distinguished Alumni Award, and was the first alumnus to give a commencement speech at that institution. So, we knew we couldn't get just a regular moderator for tonight's program. So, tonight's moderator is a civic strategist, a social entrepreneur, and a purveyor and patron of all things artistic and creative. She is the CEO of Silicon Valley Creates, Connie Martinez. So, ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in welcoming Sandra and Connie.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome, Sandra.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here. Wow.
So, congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
I loved it. I'm probably one of the few people that have read it because it just came out yesterday, right?
Yes, 2 days ago. Yeah.
Okay. So hopefully by the time we finish this interview, people will run out the door to buy it because it is fabulous.
Thank you. And we'll lock the doors, you know, until you do.
Okay. I actually don't think we'll have to.
Okay.
Okay. So let's start. So in 2011, you published an award-winning essay in The Atlantic called The Bitch is Back. Okay. My first question comes directly from your article and sets the stage for your new book. Are menopausal women mad, bad, and dangerous?
Sure. I think nobody would have ever have answered that no in the history of man. I think we're starting to understand a little bit more of what menopausal women really are. But I think that idea came, that basic article was based around, it was inspired by Christiane Northrup's The Wisdom of Menopause, mm-hmm. which had been written about 10 years earlier. And it's a great book about menopause. The only problem being it's about 700 pages. So women who are menopausal and have a short attention span and are hot flashing may not get through it in one sitting. So I wanted to do that kind of like the Menopause for Dummies version, perhaps. So, but what happens in, and I guess a kind of a thumbnail way to think about it, when answering your question is, in the old days, just think in 1900, our average life expectancy was 48. So we didn't really experience a lot of menopausal women because they were kind of done. But now our lifespan is almost to 90 and beyond. So we start to think about menopause instead of being the change, because we're only fertile that middle third of our lives. So we're mostly not that. Menopause is the return, where actually your hormone levels go back to where they were as a pre-adolescent with a little more free-floating testosterone. So you're actually returning to the state that you were before you became fertile. And what state is that, one might ask? And that is this. There's the idea that when the change is actually fertility, right? That's when you change. You were a person, and then suddenly this estrogen cloud comes down upon you. And what does this cloud do? It sort of does certain things. It changes your hormones, and it changes the way your brain works even. And you become, an example that we talk about, more nurturing. You start taking care of other people, putting other people first, being interested in boys if you're a teen, chopping up little sandwiches into 12 squares and feeding 12 people, even though they could probably feed themselves, but no, that's what mom is doing. And you start kind of nurturing and caring for others. And so supposedly when that cloud lifts, that's that scene where people remember it when growing up, where it's kind of like, remember your Aunt Edna? You know, one day she used to be washing dishes in the kitchen, and the next day she's hurling them. Why? Or, you know, or the grandmother suddenly like hurling a roast leg of lamb out the window, where suddenly this rage comes on and no one knows where it came from. But instead of that being the change, you know, Northrop argues that's when the cloud lifts. And you go, why have I been setting the table for 12 people for 20 years and doing their laundry when they were sitting around reading the paper and Googling and Wikiing and whatever else they're doing all day? It's kind of like now, it's kind of like that woman just simply returns to being the same self-involved, lazy person everybody else in the human race is. So that's where you go. So people, clearly it's more convenient to have a Stepford wife that is serving everyone, and the glue of society would not run without PTA moms, you know, baking brownies and finding mittens. But we only have to have that, I'm not going to say indentured servitude, although I guess I just did. You have that certain period of time that you do that, but that is not everything that a woman is defined by and done. So yeah, mad, bad, and dangerous, because they say, stop it! I'm not going to do this anymore.
So you are the mad woman in the Volvo.
Yeah, I guess I'm officially the mad woman in the Volvo.
So the scene, when you talk about that, when you introduce that, was very powerful. Are you willing to share this with, I mean, it's very personal and very powerful.
Sure, you mean the opening of the, when it comes
on.
So for me, and it's funny because my Atlantic editor, Ben Schwartz, was after me for years to write a piece on menopause for the Atlantic. And he said, you know, this is going to be a huge deal. Women ages 45 to 60 are America's largest demographic group. There's 50 million of us. By 2015, next year, almost one in two American women is going to be menopausal.
Listen up, men.
One in two. Think about it. And, you know, and they're kind of like running the world now. They're starting to run the Angela Merkel. It's kind of like they are, you know, menopausal women are setting currency rates and doing dental surgery and, you know, driving on our freeway. So it's a huge deal. And I said, well, that sounds like a really great piece that someone should research, and I wish I could do it, but I'm just too tired and angry and bloated and depressed and miserable. And did I say bloated? I can't remember because I'm also forgetful. So I slowly started realizing that I might be in my late 40s starting to go through these symptoms. It was about 46 that it first came on. And I wasn't, and all that happened one day is that I'm driving in my car along the freeway, and it's a picture of a working mom who's coping in a certain way. And I just, again, side note, just want to throw out this other statistic that I can't sit aside, that today an average full-time working mother spends more time with her kids per week than an average 1950s stay-at-home mother, right? Because we so overparent and have all these different activities. It used to be just get on your bike and don't come home till 6 at dinner. Now we're driving them to, you know, ballet and piano and all that kind of stuff. So you cope and cope and cope. So I'm driving in my Volvo on the freeway 134 West to get my girls from school, and it's that hideous mid-afternoon time. And suddenly, you know, I'm driving along. I'm thinking about refinancing, which usually gives me such pleasure, doesn't it? Especially recently. I'm thinking 4.275%. That's awesome. But it doesn't give that usual lift as I do when getting a really good air mile deal or something like that. I call them midlife pleasures, you know. You know, running on the treadmill and noting that AOL or Time Warner dropped their stock points. I go, yes, I want them. They make too much money in the Silicon Valley. And, you know, so, you know, I'm glad they lost money while running on the treadmill. But I'm driving along, and then suddenly I'm thinking about dinner, as one does in the mid-afternoon, which is always too late. And I remember that I promised my children we would have make-your-own pizza for Does anybody do that with their kids, that horrible thing called make your own pizza, which is like so creative and artisanal and they love it, and it's horrible because it's like the mom has to drive to Trader Joe's, get two types of ropey pizza dough, the whole wheat, the garlic herb, and the Trader Joe's parking lots are impossible. They're always too small. You know what I'm talking about. And the samples are always disappointing. It's kind of the lukewarm unfiltered apple juice and the yucky whole wheat pasta. I think there should be a rule against whole wheat pasta. It's not a destination point. Costco has better samples. But back to your point. And just at the thought of make your own pizza, I was thinking about the pizza stone and cutting up at the vegetables and having to negotiate through traffic. And my mood plummeted. It was like not like an icy dagger through my chest, or the floor of my car dropped out and I was like spinning upside down and feeling almost suicidal. I mean, it was a really wildly inappropriate reaction to something that was just an ordinary, you know, hassle, a necessity. And I go, well, I got to pull up by the side of the road and collect myself. And I pull by the side of the road, and I just start weeping and crying. I kind of like getting out heaves of water like Jonah's whale. And I'm thinking about, like, this hamster that my kids had that, like, died. And then suddenly the fact that the hamster died is the most tragic thing in the world to me. And moms sometimes have an inappropriate response to pets, and you just see their little faces and their little paws, and why do they have to die? And it's kind of like, and I'm out of control. I'm a 47-year-old woman sitting in her Volvo by the side of the road, weeping about make your own pizza and a hamster, and I've become entirely unglued. You know, the whole life that you cobble over every day with a little bit of music, a little Starbucks, little funny NPR filler music, you know, all the little things that you use to get through the day, you know, Starbucks cake pop, that's not enough. Kind of the facade lifts, and there's a howling thing underneath it that I cannot cope with life. I can't go another minute. And that's the opening of the book. Welcome to my world.
So, as women, and those of us who are in that mid, over 50, we've had these kinds of experiences. So everyone's probably thinking about something like that. You also, through your writing, and you invite women to share those stories with you. Do you have some outrageous ones to share?
About what women have done?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I would say, can I use my own example?
You just did. You mean in addition to this. Okay.
The larger one?
Yes.
Because it's kind of like, and then there's other, and the reason that I would tell it this way is because in telling this story, other people started to tell their stories of same. So it's kind of a totemic story of how women crack up. And now that I've started telling this story, people will come up and tell me that they are thinking of doing the same, but they haven't. Okay.
Please do.
And, of course, in this book, after that section, I'm in 46, and I've been a public school mother. My last book, Mother on Fire, which came out 6 years ago, was all about finding the religion of public school. All our kids turn five at the same time, and it's kind of, you can't go to public school in Los Angeles, no, but, you know, it's so big, 750,000 students in that school district, no one goes. It's like, no one? That's 750,000 kids. So we found, in a civil rights movement, many kind of like middle class educated moms like myself began kind of like going back to our public schools and bringing them up. At one point, 100 of us had camped near Sacramento to do a political rally. So we enjoyed the camping so much. We go, I just love camping with women. Now I think we're badass enough. Can I say badass? Oh, can you bleep that? You can bleep it. It's not live. Sorry. Woo! To go, we can drive an RV. Let's go to Burning Man. Always a good idea. I'm 45. I'm going to Burning. We're going to do this. We don't care if we're on hip. We're going to take lots of SPF 1000 moisturizer and beekeeper hats, and we're going there to see the art. So that was the idea. And celebrate some big major birthdays in a way where you just want to do something, you know, the older you get and you have the big birthdays, you know, 40, 45, 50, you start to get more outrageous and outlandish birthdays instead of just throwing affirmations into the fire with your wobbling Hadassah arms, as I like to say, like, sing, joy, paint or something. You want to do something a little more rock and roll. So we decided to go there. And so we went along and as our male chaperone, we took along my business partner of 10 years and my best friend. He was a man, also married. I was married, to drive us as our chaperone. And so, but what happened in Burning Man was that somehow in the middle of the desert, we were like not hydrated. It's a problem. Must hydrate. So suddenly walking around the playa, it was like this truth serum. Suddenly the moms that you were with that worked, that had these nice families and their children and the charter school movement, yeah, and we would, you know, organize ourselves and rally and, you know, beautify the schools and make the organic garden and do all that. Suddenly my most, you know, solid, you know, married mom friend said, you know what I'm going to get myself for my 45th birthday? And I go, what? And she goes, an affair. And it was like that moment where I wish I didn't hear that. I wish I had not heard that. We were all married with our kids, and I did not want to hear that she had anything else going on except what we had going. And then she just went on and on about falling in love with a traveling teacher, and it was something you do not want to hear in your 40s. You do not want to hear anyone splitting from the pack. And she said, you know, I guess when you've, but I've known him for so many years, and then one time you can look at someone and look at him in a totally different way. And I go, that's sick. But then I started thinking about my friend, my business partner who'd driven the RV, and I go, well, I guess he's kind of cute, but meh. But then I had to, like, maybe we could just flirt or something, and I said no. And so then I started talking to him. I said, I'll just kind of gossip about this. And suddenly I said, you know what, my friend Lily's thinking of having an affair, and that's ridiculous. And he goes, oh, yeah, that is ridiculous. And I go, because she says sometimes you can look at someone suddenly and see them in a totally different way. And then suddenly, as if in a dream, I go, and I now suddenly realize I love you. And my mouth kept going, and my brain was not moving. I love you, and I guess I've always been in love with you, but we're so married, and with our flat affects, we just will never do anything. It's kind of like a tragic Merchant Ivory movie of some kind. And, oh, but now I see all that I have lost, and now excuse me while I go hurl my youth into the fire. And it was kind of like this moment of, and when I'm talking about the estrogen cloud lifting, as I said, it was like a cloud lifting of suddenly I go, oh my God, I am 46 and I had figured out my life. I was married, I had kids, we just completed the remodeling of that tile that is really great. And, you know, I have my good HBO series on that I've TiVo'd. I understand TiVo now. That's good. And I have my bath, the Whirlpool bath. Then you have your life set. And then suddenly this cloud lifts at 46 and you go, this is really bad news. I'm not dead yet. I am in love. I am feeling passion. I'm feeling stuff I haven't felt since I was pre-adolescent, going back to those hormone levels. And so I went into almost an adolescent phase of just having an affair, and a pretty bad affair. I mean, there was smoking and drink. I mean, it was like, yeah, let's smoke. What else can we do that's bad? Smoke. And because it was this freedom, and it's kind of, let's make a run for it. We're like pirates. We're going to do this thing. But of course, 4 months later, then we decided to declare it to our families with a team of therapists standing by to cushion the blow. And they didn't cushion, and it didn't work out. So it was cataclysmic. I had an affair, blew up my household, got kicked out of my house. He moved back home after 4 months to, you know, to fix his family. And now I'm in a cabin alone with no TV. I am lost in the middle of my life. It's like I was supposed to be going to my Smithsonian, you know, Maya Angelou, you know, kind of like have my face on a coin, you know, or a stamp years of becoming very respected and revered as a wisdom spouting, you know, elder of the tribe. And I am like as screwed up as like a 14-year-old girl. It's a disaster. And so that's kind of the beginning of the book. So when you're thinking, what's the wackiest thing that I did? That's it. And just to blow everything up.
Kind of hard to outdo that. It really is.
It's real. No, and it's something
It's
something that you don't hear of, and it's kind of like, and we're in my tribe, which is sort of middle class educated families, the divorce rate in our demographic is as low as it was in the 1950s. People who are educated, like, stay together, you know, a lot for the kids, because we're afraid that if we kind of, like, you know, shift the balance, that our children will not get that A in, you know, algebra or something. So the divorce rate is really low, and it was just it was just like a car crash, that people would come and look in and see how I was doing, because it was explosive and ridiculous.
So you turned this into another article, so that's the way you expressed yourself and the grief and the humility.
Yes.
And you wrote, and once again in The Atlantic, the title is Let's Call the Whole Thing Off, which essentially made a case against marriage.
Yeah.
And you were even on the Today Show. I wasn't able to get it off the internet. I somehow couldn't find it. But that must have been quite a challenge, to just be so exposed. So there's that. I want to hear about how that felt and why you did it. And then, now that that's 6 years ago, would it be different today?
Boy, that's a really good chunky Commonwealth Club question right there. You know, it's like, yeah, these aren't the easy softballs I get on the show that morning. But okay, so first of all, I realized when this happened, because my persona, especially from Mother on Fire, had been of this public school mother and of this household that, you know, readers of mine knew and trusted. So there was no way to maintain that. That would have been a lie, or to go back. So in my grief and, you know, and just suffering and guilt, I sort of had to write my way out of it and actually take some of these feelings that I was still processing and think about the institution of marriage, because and I think what I found, just talking honestly from my experience, was, you know, there's, and I think women do wear so many hats today, and what I said about parenting and mothering, just the job of being a mother alone, you know, kind of like, you know, taking locally grown organic produce and home cooking meals every night at a certain meal, and, you know, not letting the children touch plastic or washing their, you know, stuff in the wrong, you know, in the wrong detergent. I mean, there's so many things layered onto motherhood nowadays that you can do that, but it is very hard to also be a romantic, sexy wife. And I think that's sort of at the core of the truth of marriage. It's been true for decades, and people have been talking about that, of once those children arrive, you know, for me, honestly, menopause wasn't the change. Childbirth was the change. When that baby came out, I became a totally different person that no one recognized. I was kind of the art girl in the dance skin leotard, you know, just at her computer doing some wacky project. As soon as that first baby came out and latched on for the first time, it's like, all I care about is this baby, and we were together all the time, and I realized there was maybe someone else in the room. It was maybe my husband. Who knew? A tree, you know, whatever, a bureau. That sometimes women have that response, honestly, that when they have a baby, it's all about that baby, and the husband, you know, kind of like a male wasp spider. I don't know. He can blow up and fly away because we're done with him. And that's kind of this hormonal reaction that really can occur in this particular time. So balancing that and, you know, running a house together and keeping the washer dryer running and feeding the pets, reconciling that with this spouse that you've been living with for 5, 10, 20, 20 years, and can you honestly say that when he walks into the room, your heart lifts in this romantic way? But somehow in this Oprah magazine era, we're supposed to do the work and the children, all we're supposed to do, but still have date night once a week so you can keep it fresh. Get babysitting for 3 hours, put on some lotion, and sort of a negligee, and feel that spark again. So that's the next thing, is kind of like, you need to also feel a spark, other than you failed at your marriage. And I realized I couldn't do all these things at the same time, that often today we have these companionate marriages where both people work and they both parent, and it's almost like more like a business partnership, or like your co-partners, co-presidents, co-companions, but keeping that you know, romantic spark open is impossible, and it's just another chore to do. Whereas some, you know, maybe people could make a, you know, a business deal and kind of go, we love our children, we love our household, we share the mortgage, we have two different bedrooms, two different entrances, we'll be friends, see you at dinner. But then after dinner, you know, I like my HBO show, you like your Fox News show, and so we can so go to bed in other ends of the house with the kind of the under the glow of our different laptops. You know, that's sort of, that's a comfortable way to be, and it's secure for the children, you know, because romantic love is really unstable, and that's a whole different kind of, you know, relationship, and that's not for everybody either. So I think just looking at how, at the burden that modern marriage puts on, in the sense of co-parenting the kids, but also, you know, thinking that you should have that Oprah date now spark, is like, those things can be really incompatible and difficult to maintain.
So would the article be the same today?
You
know
what?
Hearing yes.
I think it actually would. It wouldn't, it wouldn't be fraught with emotion, but I didn't end up talking, except for the opening, that was, end up talking really all that much about my marriage. And I think that in the end, the principles about that I have believed are the same. Because usually with divorce, there's like, don't get divorced or the children will be harmed. But in fact, I think children are quite durable. And in an article that I wrote later on Bad Mother, Germaine Greer is a writer who said, you know what, that it's more typical in nature for children to be raised by a tribe, often of mothers and grandmothers and aunts, and the men go and, go and into the forest and hunt and do what they do. But it's stable to have many mothers organizing these kids, and it's really unstable to have a family unit depend on a man and a woman to have romantic feelings for each other year after year after year. That's the most unstable thing biologically. And Helen Fisher also wrote in that article that romantic love tends to last for about 4 years evolutionarily and then tends to drift away. Why? Because that's about the time that it takes to get together, have sex, 9 months carry the baby, and give it a few years to walk around by itself, and then the family can break apart. So I think that if you look at the science and evolution and evolutionary science and biology of it, it's really interesting. And again, I would finally say, because as you know, I have studied this a lot, you know, there are very few species that are naturally monogamous in nature, and the very short list includes the anglerfish and a tapeworm called diploism something something something, and in both cases the mates are literally fused together till death. So they kind of gotta be, because they're fused together. And so, you know, and I'm not saying that it really works for humans to live in open marriages. That really didn't work. But you might be serial. You might do 20 years with one person and 40 years with the next. And I'm not going to be the one to jump on you for that.
Okay. So I love the fact that you're a scientist, and in reading the book, you bring science into the book in a very meaningful way. So here's the question about hot flashes.
Ah.
What is the science behind hot flashes leading to wisdom?
You know, I like that question. And I have an almost all too convenient answer and story about that. And in fact, and the answer isn't necessarily going to be science. There's the beauty. I guess I would answer that in two ways. One is that, as Northrop has argued, in menopause, the hormonal changes that are going, she has always argued for many years that the hormones are literally rewiring the brain. So that there are parts of the brain that they have, like the hippocampus and the amygdala, which are seats of places like hunger, sex drive, anger, memory, and those are all kind of entwined in a certain interesting way. So that your brain was actually changing during menopause, and different, you know, emotions and feelings and drives are coming up depending on how the hormones are swinging. So, and it's different for every woman that we know. With the hot flashes are interesting, and this is not going to be the scientific answer, but it's a great one that I use a lot, that there are these Tibetan monks that do this thing called Tummo Yoga. I don't know if you've heard that, where they use meditation to literally bring on these massive heat flashes on their body. And they sit out in the snow, and actually they're sweating through these sheets that they're wearing. And they use that as a way of purifying and cleansing their chakras so they can go all the way up out of their head to ascend to the next level of spirituality and to cleanse. So, you know, and Northrop has argued in a certain way that, you know, some people have argued in the certain semi-science of this that then these hot flashes that come across us are a way of just cleansing and, you know, getting stuff moving up and out of our body. I mean, that's very, you know, it's not really scientific, but the fact that they can use meditation to have these huge temperature flashes are changes that are measurable is pretty interesting. That actually connects at least the brain and brain, mind, and body in that sense. So that's not an exact answer, but also if you read some of the science of menopause, which is, again, Christiane Northrup's book, it's wide-ranging and not well understood and has a lot of different parts to it. And I think she keeps coming back to this notion of that it's hard to measure simply scientifically. You know, that doctors can try to do your hormone levels and take a hormone measurement, but they can change so much in a day that she said, actually, it's a better picture to see what your moods are doing, because that may be a more accurate and measurable thing rather than taking pictures of hormones that change just constantly, depending on what you ate to.
Okay, changing the subject a little bit to your dad. And your dad is very present in your book as
yes.
well, and in a lot of your writing. So you talk about the sandwich generation.
Ugh.
So tell us about what that means and how you have navigated it going through menopause.
Ugh, another one of these chunky Commonwealth questions. So this generation, I actually call them the triple M's, middle-aged mothers in menopause, that since, you know, and that's another sort of interesting thing. It's like I'm of a generation, I'm 52, so I'm of the late boomers, very early Gen Xers. That's why it calls Menopalooza Gen Xers. yeah, it's good, isn't it? But they didn't think that title would be understood by everyone. So what we did is we had our careers first. We were that second wave of feminism. Then I had my children at 38 and 40. I was an old mom. I always say I was like one of those National Geographic turtles, you know, pushing up on shore with her last leathery eggs. You know, there they were. And so by the time our clock is such. Actually, Irma Bombeck had this great line. She said, I'm really wondering about our generation. They've adjusted the timetable for childbearing so that menopause and teaching a 16-year-old to drive will occur in the same week. Just, I love Irma Bombeck. Gotta love her. We will be bringing her back to public radio every day, even if we're just saying her quips. So what is happening then, just completely bizarrely, is that then we are starting to, at 48 and 50, an age when, in sort of more traditional societies, the ones that made it this far, a woman could go off to a cave to be alone. We're still way in the middle of everything. You know, the average caregiver for an elder parent, and you know they're starting to live longer and longer and longer. My dad is 93 at this point, 93. And he's like a resting heart rate of like 36. He's like a lizard, so he's practically the undead already, so that when he actually dies, we won't be able to tell, but he's going on and on and on. So that we are then, the average caregiver for an elderly person is like a 51-year-old woman. So the caregiver is a woman in menopause at the age where you're going, you know what? Get your own medical tights. I don't care if they're the wrong kind. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know, the Snapple cap is hard to get off. Too bad. You know, so that she's taking care of an elder parent at the same time that she has kids and maybe even teen kids. So she may be going through menopause at the same age that her kids, in my case, I have two daughters, 18 months apart, are going through adolescence. I have two girls in middle school. Okay, so that alone... So it's really a lot of pressure on these women who are also working, you know, and it's sort of unbelievable. So in a way, and I think there's a metaphor in my whole book about sort of the cloud lifting, sort of the estrogen cloud lifting and the wisdom of menopause or the, not the change, but the return coming on is where you realize this is crazy what we are trying to do all at the same time, the working, the parenting, the frickin' exercising. I'm not gonna do Pilates ever. I'm just gonna say that now. You know, and that all the books, and then if you try to turn to get some help in this particular time while doing all of this, all the menopause books say, okay, advice is really simple. Cut out alcohol, sugar, and caffeine. If the radio audience could see the shaking heads, like a whole auditorium of people going, no, that's all some of us get up for on a Monday morning. if I may say. Who hasn't sloshed it? No, I'm not going to go that far. And, oh, you have trouble sleeping? I know women haven't slept through the night in 10 years and, you know, take an Ambien every night. They just do whatever, hit themselves over a frying pan to get to bed. It's just like, we just don't sleep. We don't sleep. It's just hopeless. And, oh, you don't sleep? Well, do some yoga stretches before bed and then have plenty of walks. Have those 8 glasses of water a day and eat lots of kale. What's with the kale? And P.S., when I was pregnant, a time when our mothers smoked, drank, and even took amphetamines prescribed to them by their chain-smoking doctors so they wouldn't gain more than 12 pounds, you know, we don't get to, you know, smoke or drink. And at some point, one guy was saying his wife couldn't have smoked fish due to secondhand smoke. Which makes no sense at all. So when we were pregnant, they said drink water and eat kale. It didn't help then. Why, when I am menopausal, I'm supposed to drink water and eat kale? Why is that the exact same advice? Which also won't work. Sorry, go.
So this is probably the time to ask you, have you looked at any alternative or homeopathic?
Yeah, sure, and I guess, you know, we're in the Bay Area, so that's gonna come up. Sure. Black cohosh tea and St. John's wort, you know. I mean, if it works for people, that's fine, but I felt in my perimenopausal fog where I kept knowing, oh, you're feeling bad because you're in perimenopause, but the next day I would forget because I'm in perimenopause that I'm in perimenopause, and I would just lie in bed and then go, I guess I should go to the health food store, but I can't remember what kind of tea that was. Black cohosh? What kind of tea was that? And also when you go to health food, you know, the health food explanations are always so long, and some, you know, salesperson is going, and you have to take this with vitamin E and D and whole foods. It's exhausting, and hemp clothing. I just couldn't find my way. And quinoa, I can't spell it. I don't understand it. So I just didn't have the attention span to thread my way through that, and to that I apologize. But I do know, and this is a sad fact, but, you know, and there are many women I know who, like, put more than half their Weight Watchers points on Chardonnay. It's just kind of simpler to remember. They can plant the points and kind of like, yeah, 6 points in wine and, I don't know, going to bed.
So you've shared the 10 signs that you know you're going through menopause.
Yes.
The audience would like to hear you.
Man, the 10 signs, I don't know them by heart, yeah. Okay, but I would say kind of like, oh, you know, heat, let's see how close I get, and you can help along, like hot flashes, night sweats, bloating, irritation, anxiety, stuff around the middle, the extra floaty that you wear. Sometimes people do panic attacks. How many is that? Because I have such a short attention span. Not able to remember. 9, not able to remember. 10, forgetfulness, sleeplessness. Yeah, I think that's like most of them. And sometimes all at the same time. And then, you know, and then you're going, well, except for the hot flashes, how different is this with my life before menopause? You know, having anxiety, depression, sleeplessness. I mean, I've been anxious and depressed and sleepless. I mean, I've been that since puberty, so it's hard to know how this is different, except for the night sweats.
So have you read the book Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother?
Oh, yes.
And any thoughts on her parenting techniques?
Of course, we're in Silicon Valley, so of course that's going to come up. And I also read a piece about it for The Atlantic, which you can Google.
Amy Chua. Chua, okay.
Yeah. You know what? That book has so much controversy around it, and I think to a certain extent, and I wrote about it, she did, there was a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek when she was writing it, and there was a little bit of self-satirization, because when she got to the end, her younger daughter Lulu just blew up. Sophia just loved the parenting technique and was the perfect Harvard child, and the younger daughter blew up. I think that, you know, to be honest, there are many of us, I'm definitely in the, not the tiger mom, but the, you know, panda bear mom or the other kind of mom, where since I was raised by a very strict Chinese dad, and we did only math at night at the table, and he would get furious if you didn't do it right, and, you know, practicing the piano. So we had a very conventional tiger dad parent growing up. And he would explode into a rage if you didn't know an answer. And that's partly a reason why I'm so happy after I got my science degree to host the Lowdown on Science, this short science minute. Because to my experience, that kind of tiger parent can actually instill a bunch of fear in a kid and maybe not inspire them to do their best work at a certain point. I think with science and math, it's not that you shouldn't be accurate, but some in the teaching of science and math, children can be humiliated fairly quickly. They can be told no. They can start to feel stupid pretty quickly. And the thing is, unlike in China where kids have to stick with school, they can just float away from science. It's very easy for American kids to just pick another major. And I think that's sad because I think they're really creative kids that just go about things a little bit differently, and they could be really good scientists if the field were a little bit larger and more encouraging. And the thing with the tiger mom, and that's perhaps my own ambivalence, is when I grew up and I got very good math scores and went into science, to a certain extent, I think some of the scientists I went to Caltech with, my hallowed institution, do sometimes think a little bit narrowly about science, and they aren't necessarily great communicators to the world about the importance of what they're doing. And that is really crucial that scientists more and more learn to do that, because we're in a world today where science literacy is at a fairly low level. You know, it's almost 50 years since man, you know, walked on the moon, and almost one in two Americans still believes in creationism. And that's kind of amazing. But I think lay people start to think of science as something over there that people in white coats do, rather than science being something about all around us every day, everywhere around us, and that is we should all know about. So, well, thank you. And so going back to the tiger mom thing, but then to a certain extent, honestly, on a personal level, which is not on my soapbox, which I do love to get on, I really do, that people should be interested in scientists and embrace their joy and their curiosity and their deductive logic, that we should all adopt deductive logic wherever we are, even if we're not scientists. I have, not like ambivalent feelings about education and what we're doing with education. Because, you know, we have kids and standardized math tests, et cetera, they score a certain way, they go to college, and then what do they do with their college degrees? And so we're sort of at a place where sort of doctors maybe make less, lawyers aren't always getting the jobs right out of college or any, scientists are sometimes shoved into narrow things. So I, when I think about my girls, you know, they could get straight A's in math and science and play the piano beautifully and play Carnegie Hall at 14, if only that is my dream. It's past, though. Then what would they do with these skills, these very academic skills? And I'm not that touchy-feely to go, oh, well, they should learn to be good citizens, but I think there's something about being in the world, understanding other people. You know, we talk about this thing, there's a thing about a 20 versus 4. America is 4% of the world, and we consume 20% of the world's resources. That's a basic fact that kids, I don't care if they're smart, dumb, or whatever, they're going to be global citizens. There's certain human intelligence and social intelligence that they really need sort of on top of these very academic skills. So with the tiger mom, I do, you know, part of me does admire her being setting strict boundaries, which I really don't, you know, I have to admit, and it's not always so great to watch. But what are we training our kids to it's really bad. What are we training our kids to do or be? Just kind of like, wow, you play the violin and you beat everybody else in the competition. Good for you. That doesn't call to me as something that I would wish on my children, because I don't know what the future is. You know, are they going to be a violinist? Probably not. I just, to be better human beings. So I think what disturbed me in that, in the Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mom book, was just the sense of competition of just beating out the other kids and being best. But how do they learn to be a sort of generous, kind human beings and to be empathetic? That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember your dad wanted you to be an engineer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He was an engineer, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so when you went to Caltech, he was probably really excited.
Oh, he was so excited. It was his dream come true.
So how does he feel about you now?
Oh, Commonwealth Club. I remember that one night at the Commonwealth Club where just the questions got harder and harder. You set up my favorite joke that I used in my commencement speech I went to Caltech and I got my physics degree, and then I went from there to go into the liberal arts, which to a Chinese father is like pole dancing. Thank you, Connie. That was great. Thanks for setting me up. Well, you know what? But here's the journey I had with that. Okay, so I went from there, and then I did all these wacky things in my 20s, and I was an avant-garde performance artist. I played piano by the side of the Harbor Freeway at rush hour and was in People magazine at one point. Okay, and so because it had all this press, people said, oh, you really should pay a publicist to keep that publicity going. And I go, I got that publicity by myself, and a publicist would cost $1,000 a month. I bet I could get more publicity if I took $1,000 and threw it over myself as I played the piano. See the left brain there? That's a Caltech education right there, working for you. So I did it at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel, and low, all the, you know, shock radio DJs put it out, and there were 200 people in the parking lot, and including my dad. So all these news cameras were there, and I start playing the piano, and the money starts dropping, and I'm literally being stampeded by people reaching across the piano and leaping on me on the keyboard to get the dollar bills. So afterwards, the news cameras come and they interview people, including mostly my dad, who is suddenly the star of the show. And he says, my daughter, all that money I spent on her Caltech education, and today is the first day I saw any money back, $4. So what happened was he started to become like a parasite on a human host. He started becoming this character that would show up at all my shows, and I did this Aliens in America, my piece, and I did My Father's Chinese Wives about him. So I would do this piece about an angry young woman who's angry at her Chinese father who made her do the science and math and was ragey and terrible, and people would then applaud. And I would say, and thank you, my dad is here tonight. And he'd slow motion stand up from the back, sometimes in a Chinese outfit, which he never wore ever, but he'd slowly rise, and in awe, people would turn to him and start giving a standing ovation. And then they would spirit him off to go for a beer, and I would be standing alone on stage in a tumbleweed. Because I realized though in my journey that, you know what, in the 50s, maybe he didn't want to work at Hughes Aircraft Company all day. He would have liked to be a street performer. Because he would catch a lot of rides with people in Malibu. Famously, he hitchhikes around L.A. because, as he said, you meet such nice people that way, hitchhiking in Los Angeles. But he would always entertain people in their cars. And so over the years, I realized he really was the entertainer. And if he had had a chance to do what I do, he might have done that and not been a scientist. So there you go.
So you have two daughters, and they're 6 and...
Oh, they're
oh,
now...
No, no.
In the book, they're 6 and 8,
that's
and
right.
Now they're 12 and 13.
Okay.
But yes.
So what do you want for them?
Well, that's a good question. You know, and it sounds... I'll give you the absolutely candid answer, and then I'll give you my PR answer. You know, I guess my PR... I'm beyond trying to pretend I'm anything other than... Like, to me, it's like... I love having them around, and it's kind of like, if you want to live with mom until you're 40, that's completely fine. You know, and like, make grandchildren for me, I will take care of them, I just can't wait. You know, so some of that is like, I just love having them around. I mean, I want them to succeed as well. I mean, I think, you know, and I think they could take a year off before they go to college as well, because a lot of kids go to college, they don't know what to do. And I think for them, I want them to find work that they're really, like anyone, that they're really interested in and passionate about and that connects them to the world and, you know, make enough money so that they can sustain themselves. But again, if I have to be part of that equation, you know, at some point, that's going to be it. And I think young women, you know, you asked the marriage question earlier, and a lot of, you know, 20-somethings sometimes ask me about how I still feel about marriage. And I guess I'm still ambivalent about whether, of course, I want a wedding. I want a big wedding and sit in the front with mom's hat and cry. But in terms of marriage, the thought of giving them away to a young man who will then support them, that doesn't make sense to me. Maybe they can support each other, but I don't know how I feel about what their way is going to be in the world. It's so different than when I started. You know, they've never seen a typewriter, only a screen. I don't know. I want them to be happy. That's what everybody wants. But I don't know what that's going to look like.
So we are in Silicon Valley, as you've pointed out several times. So we have this among women issue about how do you get more women into engineering, science, technology, because we're not well represented. So based on, I mean, part of your answers might question whether or not that's a good thing, right? But do you have any strategies or thoughts on how you would engage women more in that?
Well, the one slice that I understand, there's a great book called The Sexual Paradox by Susan Pinker that I actually also wrote about for The Atlantic. Everything I've thought about, I've written about somewhere there, so I don't really. And she said this really interesting thing of comparing genders in science and technology and in various different fields. And there's always a scary thing of like, are boys higher IQ than girls, and does that split off? And that's actually not really true. The mean is about the same. But in the spectrum, you get more boys both at the top and bottom of the spectrum. So you get more geniuses and more non-geniuses. Let's put it that way. Can we just call it that? Okay, non-geniuses. And it's a really divided spectrum. But with girls, you get the same mean, but it's sort of more evenly spread out. Sort of, it's a more gradual curve. But what happens, is that when you get, and girls usually do much better in school, but then something happens in their 20s that somehow maybe they're a little bit more obedient, or they are just kind of like following the rules, that the boys that were such laggards start doing a little bit better. The issue with science, as she pointed out, with some scientists who had dropped out, and it's kind of like physicists and chemists or women who had dropped out, is that, and the same general, and it's not specifically in this general statistical scale, a female, let's say who is 18, who is really good at science, is always is also likely to be very high scoring in her language skills. Whereas a male who is high in science tends to not be good in, have that same correlation with language. So the girls that are good at science, you can say they're sort of more well-rounded, curious in a lot of more different things, whereas the one guy, and believe me, I knew all these guys at Caltech, they got 800 on their math SAT, 520 on their English, and all they want to do is do widgets all day and go plus one, minus one on the quantum mechanics equations, and they're really into that one thing. And that kind of obsession, almost Aspergerian obsession, I one time interviewed David Pulitzer, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics, and he described being as a child, he was both dyslexic and ambidextrous. And in kindergarten, he couldn't skip. And he was almost thrown out of school because he couldn't skip. And all he became fascinated in was saws, bandsaws, chainsaws, and the pattern of, are they jagged? I don't know much about saws, but, you know, it's, or are they, you know, saws with different kinds of teeth, I guess I would say. And so he was focused on that. But because he was always checking his work, he kind of like would do these quantum mechanics equations that would go on for pages and pages, plus one, minus one, plus one, and that's all it is. And because he did it like 100 times, he came up with a negative sign instead of a positive sign, which means, oh, it's a repulsive force instead of attractive force. Nobel Prize. What do you think of that? So, but that sort of focus is kind of like, that was really good for that particular field. But interestingly, while I first went to Caltech in 1979, it was seven men to one woman. As we say, you know, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. And it's the first time I ever said that one. I'm sorry about the chestnuts that are so old, they come, but they're still good, aren't they? But that recently, in the last few years, they graduated one class of chemical engineers, and it was all women. Wow. And there was not one man at Caltech chemical engineers, all women. And that was because the field of chemical engineering has a lot of both calculation and real-world problems and applicability. So it was kind of like a wide enough field that you need scientific excellence, but it has some interesting applications that are just more fascinating than going plus one, minus one, plus one, minus one, which is also good. So I think that in terms of using all the things that women do, you know, really high science, but make it applicable to the world and broader things, I think might be more appealing to more smart women. Not for all necessarily, but that's one thing that has been sort of shown in the studies of how our brains are a little bit different.
What do you do to stay creative?
What do you do to stay creative? That's a good question. I mean, I think for me, and it sort of comes back to what we talked about sort of at the beginning of, I think for me, the most interesting process in writing creatively is not necessarily knowing the answer or having the statistics. I know with this particular book, because the statistics of menopause are just so one in two American women, it's amazing. So those things that you can bang out, and that's for all the world to know, and those are extraordinary things. For me, transforming something like even that experience that I had of pulling by the side of the freeway and weeping and doing that seemed like a very undigested, unfunny, unentertaining, uncool experience that one wouldn't want to even share to a friend, because you can't make it funny in a funny tale. It's not really entertaining, and that's why in life we don't say, how are you? And nobody goes, I'm crying all day. You know, they don't do that because it's not a good story. So for me, it's creative to try and transform the stuff of life that seems dull and uninteresting into actually what we live every day and the reality of what our lives really feel like, and be bold enough to say that. And so to me, that's a very creative process.
I love that answer. I do. So co-parenting. And you know, what you didn't do is finish the rest of the story about what hopefully you'll all read about, Mr. Y. So maybe put the two of those together. So Mr. X and Mr. Y,
right.
Put those them in context, and then talk about co-parenting.
All right. Well, and I don't want to give away the whole book, but we are talking about this. So I did become divorced. I had the affair. I did become divorced. And then Mr. Y, eventually, actually, we got back together again after a period of time. And so now my kids are 50. They go back and forth between households based on basically my ex-husband's work schedule, because he travels a lot. He's a brilliant musician. So I experience... To be totally honest, and this is one of those things that's going to get, that like causes a lot of trouble, but because of that statistic that I gave you earlier, that the full-time working mom spends more hours with her kids per week than the stay-at-home mom did, I have found that having the kids come in and come out so I can rest and then come in again has been kind of a lifesaver for me. Honestly, you know, it's kind of like, man, I get to be such a better mother than I was. It gives, you know, and if they look at the happiness of women, that they go, you know, if you go married men, divorced men, married women, it's kind of like the least happy demographic is married mothers in happiness. And then they look at these demographic studies of women's liberation, and like women are report being less happy than they were before. And I think for us, when I used to single parent my kids alone when he'd be on the road, it would be just such a low level sort of misery, unjuggling all the time of way too many things going on, and they would want to make lemonade, and I say, no way are we going to make lemonade, because that's another hideous project that's going to take all the time, and you're going to be cleaning it up all the time. That's a thing. You're always washing stuff until you just stop, and then you're free, and just let it pile up. But I found, and this is sort of a, going back to co-parenting, that because I can really parent, they come in on the weekend, we do make your own pizza, we bake pie, we bike, we do all things that I never would have dreamed of going before, and then they go away for a few days so I can recover and just do my work and watch Breaking Bad if I need to till midnight and then pay for it in the morning by sleeping in, but then I can be refreshed and come back to them, and I've actually had some married mothers go, oh man, I really envy your schedule, because you get a couple days off and then come back on. So in terms of co-parenting, you know, we have two different households, and he runs his household his way. I run mine, and there's sort of a wonder of it. I mean, our values are basically the same, but they, I don't know, because my girls in their middle school, I think they sort of enjoy going back and forth. It gives them sort of a freedom. They can be one person with one parent. They know with me, they always trick me into taking them into movies that are not G. And we were talking about work, kind of like I'm going, okay, they want to see the new Jennifer Aniston family movie, Meet the Millers. And I'm like going, is this an R-rated movie we're sitting in? And then they go, yeah, and that's something. And then we laughed. But that's something they know they can't trick their dad into because he's too smart. So maybe it's a little bit of rebellion that they're getting now in a safe way. So I'm hoping that it's going to work out.
It's hard to believe, but we're down to our last question.
Wow.
Time has gone by.
It has flown.
Yeah. So I want to go back to menopause. We started there. We're going to end there. So at the end of your book, you lay out 8 tips, menopause tips. Could you share your favorite and expand on any others that you think the audience should hear tonight?
Well, I think it's very important to give up kale. Just say, you know what, you cruciferous vegetables, out, never again. No. Well, it's like mocking, but I think that's the crucial thing I found when I read these books is that I was being more and more to-do lists about how to deal with my menopausal symptoms. So my here's what I would say at the end. I finally talked to my dream gynecologist, and she said this great thing. When I actually finally, it took me a year to go to her because I didn't want to be weighed. You know, going to the doctor, you put it off because you go. And she said, you know, there's 2 kinds of girls in this world, the Chinette girls and the paper plate girls. The Chinette girls, you put a lot of stuff on their plate and they don't crack. The paper plate girls, you put a carrot on and it's just like, ooh, it goes away. So she goes, at heart, I think you're a Chinette girl. You're strong. But as a woman, you need to do 2 things. One is to take things off your plate right now. So don't, the carpool, the PTA, whatever, feeding the dog, you know, just take the, well, feed the dog, automatic feeder. Take those things off your plate to lighten your load. And I think that's really important. So the first thing is kind of like to lower your standards for everything. And one thing that I would say is, like, for instance, you know, we go, I should put a home-cooked meal on the dinner table every night made from locally sourced organic vegetables that I slow cook, you know. I'm sorry. Also, the slow cooking thing and the men writing about the beauty of slow cooking and how beautiful that is. I'm sorry. That's for another day. You know, we mothers have been cooking for years. It's not necessarily a beautiful thing. Or it can be. So we, you know, it's kind of like if sometimes dinner is 3 kinds of white food, you know, mashed potatoes, rice on a biscuit while eating SpongeBob, so be it. You know, they're going to learn vocabulary from SpongeBob. That's fine. So the first thing is to just lower your standards of everything. It's amazing that we're doing all the things that we're doing. It's too much already. And if you have ants in your car, as I do, or feeding them all white food, it's fine for today. Just get through the day. But the second thing I would say is, like, do anything that you can to ease yourself. Get things that you look forward to, and it's kind of like, don't take out the next laundry list of Pilates and walks and kale and all that kind of stuff, which becomes more things that you dread to do in a day. Just, you know, if you need, like, some chocolate, one woman says she has, like, a Dr. Pepper every morning. I don't know why, but it makes her feel good. Big cheesy sandwich, you know, some, like I said, put half their Weight Watchers points into wine. It works for them. You know, whatever they need to do to get through this temporary period, because perimenopause is that wacky period. This period will pass and you'll feel better. But in this particular time, you just have to shore yourself up in perimenopause and do anything you can to get through the day and to bear up with it and cope with it. Get a massage. Stay in bed. I think bed rest for 48 hours can be wonderful. You know, and as a mother, and sometimes we berate ourselves for being not good enough mothers, and I think as long as you don't put your head in the oven, like Sylvia Plath, like, you're doing great. The bar is very low. The bar is very low. Just stay alive, and that'll be great. I think stay alive. That's it. If you can manage that. All right.
A reminder, of course, that this evening's program was brought to you by the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, and the contemporary Asian theater scene. I hope you enjoyed this program as much as I did. And again, we want to thank Sandra Singh Loh, author of Mad Woman in a Volvo, My Year of Raging Hormones, and Connie Martinez, CEO of Silicon Valley Creates. Our audience here in Mountain View, and to those of you joining us on the radio. And now, regrettably, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Now, before you get up.